My name is Mel Peel, and the title of this session is Two Kingdoms and One Republic, Lutherans and American Politics. And perhaps I should explain that maybe somewhat mysterious title a little bit. Some of you might have figured it out. The two kingdoms is the phrase that is at least traditionally used to describe what is considered the traditional Lutheran attitude toward the problem of the relation of church and state, or religion and politics, or the sacred and the secular. So that phrase, although I don't think actually that Martin Luther specifically said two kingdoms, but he often talked about the kingdom of the right hand and the kingdom of the left hand. So people added those up and got two kingdoms. And that's the descriptive phrase traditionally for what is said to be the distinctive Lutheran teaching about that particular problem deriving from Martin Luther. Now, there are a great many difficulties in the interpretation of that teaching and the historical transmission of that teaching, and I'm going to say just a little bit about that later on. The One Republic, of course, is the United States. America is a republic. The kingdoms that Luther was referring to, although they obviously might have been the monarchies of his day, aren't really forms of government. So in a way, I'm playing with this idea of kingdoms and republic. He meant secular government in general, whatever its particular kind of form. But in a sense, the exercise that I'm going to engage in a little bit here with you is to think about this problem of a religious tradition or a religious community or a religious community carrying a religious tradition in a particular society, a particular place, a particular kind of political order. In this case, Lutherans in the United States in their interaction and relationship with American politics specifically. And obviously, we could say in the abstract that, well, it shouldn't make much difference whether Christians of any kind, or Lutherans in particular, exist in one kind of society or another. But it seems to me that, in fact, what happens is that every religious tradition, as it's lived out, is lived out particularly in a particular kind of place in society and condition, and that it takes on a different sort of character and form depending upon the kind of social order that it exists in. Or you could describe it the reverse. You could say the social order has an impact upon the way the religious tradition is understood. And so there's a mutual interaction there. So that's what I'm going to do just a little bit here, and hopefully invite some of your thoughts and comments on this. First, what I'm going to do is just provide a very brief capsule account of what I would describe what a historian or a political scientist or someone looking at the experience of Lutherans in North America would say about their interactions with the political order, how they would describe it. And there are some studies that have done this, not real extensively, but enough to have some handles on this, so that you can sort of describe, at least at the broad level, what factors and influences and how Lutherans have behaved in relation to the American political order over a period of time. And I'm going to say something about that. Obviously, too, there are things about how Lutherans have understood their own interactions with the political order in general and the American political order in particular. These are much harder to get a handle on because how people see things is much harder to describe than how they behave. But I'm going to say a little bit about that, and then end up with what I think are some of my own reflections on strengths and possibilities that exist for the Lutheran community, particularly, although perhaps to some extent for all religious communities in relation to American public life and politics, but also some of the weaknesses and difficulties that exist there. Okay. Well, with that by way of background, I should say that it seems to me that the two broad historical, cultural, theological factors that have operated on most of the Lutheran community in the United States in shaping its fundamental social, political outlook have been the twin experiences of the theological, formations derived from Lutheran tradition, particularly this idea that there somehow is a gap between our religious experience and our political experience. And the way that has usually gotten interpreted for most Lutherans over time is that these two somehow exist in separate spheres. The usual popular interpretation of the two kingdoms in the Lutheran tradition has been faith is something that belongs to me or to my family or perhaps to my church in our worshiping function, and that is a very precious possession, all the teachings of grace and salvation and so on and so on. But that exists apart from the world of public affairs, at least the world of power and politics. That is a separate universe that operates according to other rules. And when we move out of our faith community into that public arena, we are really passing across a very great dividing line. Now, it would be interesting to look at and see whether that is in fact how, for example, Martin Luther understood this teaching of the two kingdoms. I personally don't think that's the case at all. His understanding was really very much more complex than that. Certainly, if you look at Luther, let's say, the idea that faith should not affect politics is simply incomprehensible, because he spent much of his time ordering around princes and telling them what God said they should do and things like that. He was completely involved in the politics of his day, very much engaged in matters of which prince should line up with this and arranging alliances and all kinds of other things. So it's certainly hard to argue that these two things should never intersect on the basis of at least Martin Luther. But as most Lutherans have historically understood it, I think that's the case. The idea of a split here. And the two traditions the two phrases you can use to describe what have been characteristically Lutheran attitudes toward politics are pietism and quietism. That is, pietism, the belief that personal faith is the key and personal piety is the key, and therefore the religious community does not exist primarily in its public and certainly not in a political dimension. And quietism is probably even more descriptive. Even if the religious community exists as a public agency, institution, its basic function is to witness to salvation by Christ and to uphold the true faith, the two true teachings of the church. And the idea that religion would motivate you to act in political kinds of ways is on the whole a very foreign one. In other traditions, I should mention, for example, particularly those derived from Calvinism, John Calvin, Reformed traditions, Puritan traditions, which have had very great influence on the United States, this idea doesn't exist. There's much more the notion that what religion does is motivates you to go out and shape society in accord with religious ideals. So that idea was very powerful in the United States and always has been. But Lutherans coming into that experience have not really, on the whole, shared that kind of outlook. And in fact, they've generally been extremely suspicious of it. And the result is that they have tended to sort of huddle within the political order on the whole, not take an active role, not take an active lead, and so on. I think this was compounded by the historical experience that most Lutherans basically came to this country as peasant immigrants out of Central and Northern European countries. Almost all of them came out of countries where there was a state church, a rigid political hierarchy, very formal kinds of institutions that dealt with matters of power, which were utterly remote from the experiences of most people who felt themselves either oppressed or ignored, or certainly, you know, politics was something way up there that princes and other people dealt with, and you mostly tried to stay out of the way to keep from getting trampled on. Or at the very least, you simply protected your own interest as best you could under those circumstances. There was almost no experience with the kind of political order that you have in the United States, where there's this emphasis upon democracy and the role of the citizen and the people govern and all people are created equal and the governors are our servants, and all that kind of language was historically, on the whole, mostly foreign to most of the Lutherans who came into this country. So that their natural tendency, I think, was again to be somewhat shocked and taken aback and not quite prepared for this idea that you are now the governors. You're in charge here. You're supposed to be shaping the public policy. And this is a rather peculiar kind of notion. And of course, most people coming out of essentially peasant or working class backgrounds did not feel themselves qualified or interested in or particularly eager to engage in that kind of activity simply at the sociological level. They were immigrants, foreigners, mostly ended up in out in farming communities or working class in cities and so on. So they didn't have a great deal of opportunity to participate in politics. Well, beyond that then, you can say that a number of factors over the course of time perhaps operated in the shaping of Lutheran political attitudes as they developed. And some of these could be traced out of this interaction of religious tradition with the particular experience in the United States. And I would say that on the whole, most Lutheran communities sort of operated defensively. They, to the extent that they took political stances, they were not because they were aggressively pushing a particular kind of attitude or outlook, but because they were resisting and protecting what they took to be attitudes or outlooks that were threatening or undermined their own understanding of how the political order should operate. And the two outlooks that I would describe here in the way that you can look at the way most communities have acted over time that where there's been a preponderance of Lutherans have been reaction to what they understood to be the dominant Yankee Calvinist forms of society and politics. That is, in places where there were sort of aggressively Anglo-Saxon movements to attempt to shape political and social and even in some cases religious orders, Lutherans generally sort of resisted that. They were sort of the outsiders, the foreigners, so they would sort of huddle together and try to protect their communities against that kind of inroad to a great extent. The other motive that would pop up and to some extent bounce off of that and react with that was anti-Catholicism. Most Lutherans, especially German Lutherans, came to this country with the experience of battling with the Catholicism in Central Europe and the idea that the papacy, of course, was a great threat to both religious and political freedom was a very strong one. So you also had the motive of, well, let's steer clear of the Catholics. So a lot of people who studied these voting patterns, you can find places where it's almost sort of whatever position the Catholics are taking, the Lutherans will take the other one. And that's sort of a lot of, and whichever party the Catholics belong to, which is mostly democratic in the 19th century, the Lutherans will pick the other one. Actually, early on, it's let's preserve our own concerns and communities, and did not attempt to take a very large role in those sorts of public affairs. And in fact, there was a great deal of suspicion of the churches that became involved in those things, particularly what was understood to be the social gospel, which was the great social teachings of many of the Protestant churches around the turn of the century. And you can find all kinds of statements by Lutheran church people saying, well, we know what we're not. We're not these social gospel people who go out and link Christianity with housing reform or something. That's not what we do. We uphold the particular faith. Well, one more generalization I'll make here, and this is a rather interesting sidelight and presents a somewhat different cast, I think. I've talked up to this point primarily about what I would call domestic politics. That is how people have looked at the relationship between their religious community in the society. But there always, of course, is the matter of foreign affairs as well. How do you deal with nations abroad? And while I would still say that on the whole, the Lutheran community, again, has tended to follow those patterns of quietism, not to take strong stands on particular kinds of policies. On the other hand, it is rather interesting that, especially in the 20th century, people who study this kind of thing, you can see that the Lutherans, in contrast to some of the other religious communities, have tended to have a somewhat more skeptical attitude toward particularly American military involvements, foreign policy involvements, and sort of the aggressive expansion of the United States into the rest of the world. And I mentioned this particularly in relation to the two world wars, which were of course very formative for many people. And if you think about it, you can probably figure out part of the reason for that. While perhaps it might have come from convictions of religious attitude toward war, that may have been operating there. But even more potently, I think, was operating the connections that still existed to Europe, particularly for Scandinavians and also for Germans, Lutherans in this country. And so to the extent that the United States, particularly in World War I, of course, the crusade against Germany and the Hun was a real fervent affair, that was much harder for certainly German Lutherans and also for Scandinavians to sort of demonize Germany that way. In fact, before the war, many of them had been very sympathetic to Germany. So there was, and during the war, many German Lutheran communities particularly were subject to very harsh persecution. People would, you know, groups of local patriots would invade churches and say, no more preaching in German, laws to prevent any more school teaching in German, things of that sort. And similarly, many of the Scandinavian churches, the Scandinavian countries tended to remain neutral in the war, and so tended to look upon the wars, these wars, as with a little bit more distance, and to have a somewhat skeptical outlook on the belief that that we, the United States, were the carrier of righteousness and truth in the world, which was, of course, the dominant way these wars were interpreted. And to a somewhat similar extent, although probably to a lesser degree, the same thing in World War II. Even though World War II, you obviously had this horrible figure of Hitler, and it seemed like this great war against evil, still, if you read the statements out of the Lutheran communities at that time, there isn't quite this same sense of fervor that there was in large sectors of American society at that time. There's more a sense of tragedy and the horror of the war already, even while it was going on, what was happening to those countries. Certainly, people were anti-Nazi, and particularly many of the Scandinavians, the Danes and Norwegians, after Hitler invaded those countries, there was a strong conviction against that Hitler had to be done away with. But there was also a sense that this was a great tragedy, and there was a great emphasis upon what's going to be done to rebuild the world and so on and so on after the war. So at least I see in international affairs, although not as great an extent perhaps as could have occurred, that there is an interest in and a concern for moderating some of the crusading side of American international involvement and foreign policy. Well, let me just sort of lead us up to the present era and the post-World War II era and the current political social environment a bit. And this is something that you all can contribute as well as I can in thinking about how religion and politics intersect among these kinds of communities. Obviously, the character of Lutheran communities, Lutherans in their social economic environment has changed dramatically since World War II. As with Roman Catholics and some other people who came out of immigrant traditions, on the whole, you have had a great boom of prosperity, right? Most people moved to the cities, off of the farms, or at least to towns. You had the great rise of American income in the period after the war. Many people became more affluent, suburbanized, and so on, incorporated into the American mainstream. So to that extent, even more closely identified with the American dream, the dominant suburban middle class, and most of the political behaviors that you could discern would be fairly indistinguishable from those of the people in the communities where they live. Here and there you can find little dissents from that, but on the whole, there's that kind of integration into the larger community. But then, of course, you have the great social political movements of particularly the 1960s that sweep across the American landscape and shake up the whole society in many ways. And I also think began to cause some questioning and dissent and concern and interest in this matter within Lutheran communities as well, including the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War movement, and so on. Now again, if you look at this statistically, you would still say that Lutheran communities on the whole behave very quietistically. They don't get involved in political activity, even to the extent of just ordinary politics. For example, one thing you can cite is that the number of Lutherans who participate in politics is far below the percentage in the population. Far below. If you take, for example, members of Congress, there are, I don't know what the figure is, something like three times the number of Episcopalians in Congress than there are Lutherans, even though the Episcopalian community is far smaller. And not to mention something like Roman Catholicism, which in some respects, of course, shares the same sociological history, but where politics has always been a very important vehicle for the community. So you've always had lots of Roman Catholic politicians, and I forget what the figures are. If you take the Congress in the last 10 or 15 years or something, over a fifth or a quarter are at least always Roman Catholic. And there's a very strong emphasis in the community on the figure of the Roman Catholic politician, Irish Catholic, German Catholic, Polish Catholic, or whatever, as an important community figure. And I don't think that same kind of thing exists in the Lutheran context. However, there are some areas and places where Lutheran communities have produced leaders and so on, and certain areas where they tend to dominate just numerically. So you do get a certain kind of political outlook. Minnesota would be the most obvious, some of the upper Midwest states, North Dakota, you still, maybe Minnesota's a place where you still have a Lutheran state church, I don't know. But in most places you would not find just objectively much particular conspicuous involvement in particular sorts of political concerns, even ordinary political concerns, much less a very dramatic involvement in social concerns or social causes or whatever. However, there have arisen some minority groups and movements within Lutheran communities that have strongly pushed these concerns in the last 15 or 20 years. And that has created a different kind of dynamic and atmosphere, I think. And many Lutherans have become more accustomed to hearing from church leaders, we need to become interested and involved in these concerns. And you have active minorities working on causes. For example, probably the one that people certainly around places like this hear about, Namibia. Let's take an interest in the cause of freedom for Namibia, or interest in matters of civil rights in this country. Those things have worked through the churches, but it's still an open question, I think, to what extent that kind of activity sort of percolates down to the grassroots. And this is the final question I sort of leave you with. It's the same one I raised a little bit yesterday in talking about varieties of religious politics in America, is to what extent people, ordinary lay people, think about their political involvements in the larger society as shaped by religious considerations, or do they draw that barrier and say, well, yes, our theology is very important over here, but when I move into my public role, I sort of drop that off, and I don't take an interest in those things. And I certainly don't attempt to see how my religious outlook might shape my views on economics, housing, foreign policy, the kind of people I vote for, and so on and so on. I think that's a kind of open question. The polls, again, if you can believe polls, and I'm not sure I always do, but there have been polls taken on some of this kind of thing, and it's rather interesting that, as in most of the Protestant churches, there's a considerable gap between the way that church leaders and pastors and church officials see these matters and the ways that ordinary lay people see them. And the figures are often about 2-1 if you ask, for example, should church people become actively involved in campaigns to stop nuclear war? And if you poll the pastors, it will be about 2-1 or more saying, yes, indeed, we should. That should be a crucial function of the church. But if you poll lay people, it'll flip over almost the reverse, 2-1 against, saying, no, we shouldn't. And incidentally, just for those of you who like to lift beneath the cover, this even goes to things like party affiliation. If people are telling the truth to the pollsters, Lutheran pastors are predominantly democratic in their outlook in voting, and some of them even further over in the political spectrum. Lay people are overwhelmingly still Republican, and fairly conservative Republicans at that. So even in that kind of a relationship, you have that sort of difference and gap. Well, I partly use this then to set you up for some discussion, I hope, and thought about this matter, and perhaps, you know, there could be room for another session on the two kingdoms today, or how do we think about this matter. It's a real theological problem, I think, that I'm not directly addressing here, but certainly Lutheran theologians are very much interested in that, and wider Christian communities as well. And I don't think this should be looked on as a matter of tribal loyalty. That is, you know, how do we get more Lutherans into office or something, although I know of some people who sort of think that way. But more a question of how do we as a Christian community operating in a particular kind of tradition interpret this interaction between our religious tradition and our political and public life. And I want to conclude by just mentioning what seemed to me some strengths that the Lutheran tradition has in relation to acting in public life and politics, but also some weaknesses, and maybe this will provoke some thoughts and discussions. Among the strengths I would mention is that there is this historical, social, religious experience of being somewhat outside the mainstream originally. And to me, that's a kind of strength. Lutherans haven't felt sort of responsible for everything that's gone on, and on the whole have had a little bit of distance from the American dream and the American state and so on. And to me, that seems like a strength. People can still remember their immigrant ancestors and identify with those who perhaps are coming into the country from the bottom today, or are looking at things a bit from the outside. And even though those memories have obviously faded, they never entirely disappear, and that seems to me to be a genuine a sort of strength. Another one is that the tradition, Lutheran tradition, as I would understand it anyhow, would emphasize very strongly that any kind of action, any kind of moral response in the world is derived from faith, and not vice versa. That is, we don't start out with a particular kind of cause and then line our faith up with that. We examine our faith and decide where that leads us. And to me, that seems like a genuine strength. It avoids many of them temptations to sort of baptize whatever cause is coming down the pike, and lets us think about seriously the relationship between faith and the response to faith in moral, social, and I would even add political action. Another strength, it seems to me, and this gets a little more theoretical, is the emphasis upon the fact of living out faith in the world, but without necessarily expecting to build here a perfect world. And the dynamic of interaction between the necessity of carrying out your convictions into a public sphere, of attempting to work for those communities of peace and justice and so on that one might expect on the basis of the Christian gospel, but without necessarily demanding that our expectations turn out the way that we would like, seems to me to be a genuine strength. Because, as you know, people who get very committed to causes, there's a strong temptation to build up those hopes so high that if they're disappointed, not only is the objective reality disappointed, but your faith is shattered as well. So to me, it in a sense, the emphasis in our tradition upon the sinfulness of people, the failings, the inevitable weaknesses of life, can... Well, that's my presentation. I'd certainly welcome your comments and thoughts, and if I seem to have gotten things right or wrong. Partly this is a little bit of a shot in the dark, I suppose.
Yep. Wouldn't you say Lutherans historically in this country have been a minority because of the segregation of the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Germans when they came into this country and really not work together, but actually went their own race.
Well, the ethnic factor, in other words. I mean, yeah, and of course, again, I didn't say that for many people, probably it was more important being a Norwegian than it was being a Lutheran. And, you know, your identification with your ethnic community more defined the public side of your social life than your religious affiliation did. And that was certainly true in many of the Scandinavian communities and the German ones, too. So there you have a case of sort of ethnicity taking over, being more important, really, for many people's way of understanding themselves and their communities than religion. Now, theologically, I would think that's not good, right? I mean, it should be more important, the faith you belong to, than the particular ethnic background you belong to. But I think you're right.
I think it had an impact on the movement.
Sure.
They were a minority in that
community. Sure, and they were divided minorities as well. Yes. And again, I perhaps didn't mention that enough, but part of this assimilation process has also been the slow breaking down, maybe slower than you think if I hear people from up here talking, but the slow breaking down of these more tightly knit ethnic communities, you know, where people grew up knowing primarily German Americans or whatever. It seems to me that there's the experience of just culture shock. Nothing in most American Lutherans' background and tradition prepared them for the last 30 years. I mean, there just weren't many signals for what, boom, and here you are in this new world in a number of ways that was completely unpredicted and unprepared for. And I think it's even very hard for leaders then to start interpreting things to communities, much less for communities to know whether, well, aren't our leaders now off, you know, whoring after false gods, or they seem to be departing from what we always did. But what we always did may have been related to a very particular kind of experience and environment, perhaps valid for its day, but Is that where we are now? And I think that's very good. Yeah.
One of the major changes that's occurred lately is our merger. Do you see any impact this is having in our political activities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be interested to hear from some of you on that. I mean, it appears to me from some of what I read that there is here, and again, an attempt to say that the Lutheran community is opening up to a wider public in a way that it hasn't before. Coming out of its shell a little bit. And this is kind of strange. We're not used to being noticed by other people. But when you get 5.5 million people, you're not as invisible as you were when you were, you know, again, most of these churches, of course, you know, most Lutheran synods start out, there were, what, 30 of them or something long ago, and they were pretty invisible. I mean, unless you belong to one of these little tribes, nobody much noticed. But now you have this much larger institution. And I think it is interesting to ask about that, but also I think following somewhat frightening as well. That is, you don't know where is this headed, and I think some people are worried that now this is going to turn into, is this going to be a social gospel again, and selling out our whole heritage, and now we have a bunch of people running around and are taking up causes and are going to undermine the faith by promoting this or that cause. But perhaps what's needed again is to reinterpret and understand the essence of a tradition in relation to this new environment. And I guess my own little hobby horse here would be to say that this should be a process that not just goes on among the top. It shouldn't be just something that church officials and pastors do, but it should get down into communities. And lay people should have a role in this and think through this and be talking about this. Because I think that is a danger. That obviously you respect your leaders, but if that's the only way it's done, because when you enter the public world, you do so as a lay person, not as, you know, a member of the church. And that's where your greatest impact is in your role as citizen, in your role as member of a community, in your role in the workplace, and so on and so on. Yes.
As you were talking, I was comparing my own experience with it, very much like what you described. And most of the people that I've known in the ministry, friends and so on, have been very socially active, or at least fought a lot of social action, and yet the congregations were pretty laid back. It seems as though it was the notion that, well, God's plan will work itself out. I don't really need to do very much myself, because in the long run, this will all come about. And so at the congregational level, there seemed to be this have faith in a sense in God's will. But with the new church, now the key word seems to be ecumenism. And it seems as though that's another expression of God's plan. It will all work out. God intended us all to be one in the church, and it sort of raised it to another level of this, it'll all turn out all right, God's plan, and ecumenism is the way that this will happen, rather than at the congregational, lay back and let it all happen.
Do you see that as beginning to break down this attitude, or is this just a new expression?
I think it's a new expression.
Expression of the still of sort of passivity and quietism, deeply rooted, that, well, now some church officials are going to, is that, so, that might be a problem. I mean, you certainly wouldn't want the idea that God's will is at work and is going to shape things, that's essential. But how we interpret that in relation to our own lives and our own public lives is another whole question. And as I say again, I don't think we, and I'm speaking here at Lutheran, I know other people come from different traditions, but have been very good at working through that interaction. And maybe all you do is take the same old wine and put it in different wine skins. And I would like to think that there are some bubbles popping up here and there that might create some ferment.
I thought it was really interesting because I've lived with that contrast with a Norwegian Lutheran mother who thought our life should be privatistic and stay within our community, keep our nose out of other people's business, and take care of this little community right here. And with an Irish Catholic father, who is still at 87, is on community councils, as he has been on television in Seattle. He's done all this for all his life.
You had it right in your own family.
He has been.
How did they vote?
Well, he.
I'm certainly not. I guess I wouldn't be an expert on how to organize and arrange churches. One of my approaches would be to simply say, get some conversation going about these things, and start really thinking them through in public kinds of ways, and not keep them hidden. I don't know where these things get talked about, probably in the back corner of the narthex or something, I don't know where people hash out this sort of thing, or maybe when they're at a party or something, they say, boy, that guy's completely off base again. I think there may be ways that are non-threatening to start to think through these. Perhaps there are theological perceptions that have developed in leadership circles that have validity. On the other hand, perhaps church leaders have not thought through the problems that people who are not professionals, who are working in farming or business or labor or whatever professions, issues that they have to deal with in terms of this relationship between the public and private. And I think that should be brought out, but not in the sense of a kind of conflict or, I think that probably is often how it pops up. And of course, it seems to me, just my observation, is that in a way pastors are terribly vulnerable. Even if they believe something very strongly, people think they're in charge, but really they're awfully vulnerable, That if the community thinks that, boy, they've gotten on base, especially on something like this, they can be in trouble real quick, even a significant minority. So it seems to me you need some ways within a Christian community to raise these questions and talk about them and discuss them that isn't in a conflict environment, and maybe waiting before the latest controversy comes down the pike. That's usually when it gets talked about, right? Somebody's done something outrageous or sent off this statement, now people are mad. So somehow that's not the perfect environment for communication. Yes.
Maybe one of the healthy things that's happening in the Lutheran Church today is that there are more people coming into the church who aren't of the Scandinavian German kind of heritage who are marrying some of Lutheran and coming in and saying, hey, why aren't you guys involved? And I think that's really healthy.
Some of them are even marrying Irish Catholics.
Yes. How does this issue of privatization of religion, how does it interface with the idea of being a good Samaritan?
I could offer a tentative answer on that. I mean, I would say that I would want to distinguish in part between direct social service. And actually, I didn't say this because I was talking about politics, but Lutherans on the whole, actually, in this country, have been quite good on the matter of providing immediate aid to people. I mean, you have a lot of social agencies of all kinds, orphanages, retirement, hospitals, social family services, immigrants, and things like that, that are interpreted as helping people. But the line, and that is understood to be a part of the heritage, but the line is drawn at anything that smacks of power, politics, whatever. You know, the Good Samaritan did not go out and demand better highway protection. You know, didn't call for new police forces to create clear up robberies on the road. He just provided immediate aid to the victim. So that would be my answer, the way most people would interpret that. It's good for the church, and it's good for church people to aid individuals or aid people in their suffering. But it's a whole different matter if we start talking about anything like how do we handle housing policy, or what should we do about Namibia, or whatever. This makes many people far more nervous because they don't see, and our tradition does not tend to support that as something legitimate for the church to do. And again,
So if we go out to get better protection for the highway, then we would feel we're interfering in
the state.
Out of our realm.
Yeah, that's the other kingdom. That's the rule of God by his left hand, and that is for the function of politics. And while we might do that in our capacity over here, we didn't want to let any influences from our religious motive get over into that other sphere. So we tend to sort of sort those two worlds into two separate environments. One of the interesting things, it seems to me, and I don't know how much of this goes on, but the idea that the church officially should not be taking the lead anyhow in political questions, you can argue about that theologically. It's much harder to argue, and many people I know around here, certainly at Holy Village, are involved in Christian citizens getting together and saying, we as Christian citizens will do X. We're not committing the church as an official agency, but we as Christians are getting together to say we want this, or our government ought to respond on this. And in a way, it seems to me that model is more compatible with the Lutheran tradition, because it's harder to say that there's anything wrong about a group of people, lay people or even pastors, getting involved in something where they're not making it, they're not passing it through the official church document, but they are simply acting on the basis of their faith in the larger world. Some of you may have experience with that, I don't know.
Which says something about us too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still the tribal thing. Even though it's now half a world away and interracial, it's still our folks. That I think you're raising a very interesting and touchy point. Good point.
Well, I think it's because we don't have to change our own way of living.
Yes.
By sending,
that's right.
I think it's easier to send out. It's always been easier to send missionaries to
far
Africa.
Away.
And there are churches, that have sent missionaries out that would not accept those same people in their own church. Because
on racial questions, say racial questions, for example. We're glad that God is calling black people to faith over in Africa, but boy, they better not show up in our neighborhood. How do you reconcile that with Christian faith? I can't. But I think you might find that in some church environments.
Isn't that changing now? That's still happening.
It's changing.
Slowly.
Slowly. You think it's still going on?
Sure.
Or American Indians. I mean, actually, if you want to look at the minority, if I'm doing this sociologically, the minority that most American Lutherans are closest to, geographically, historically. Well, and again, I mean, a part of the experience of coming to terms with the whole of American history experience is the interracial encounter. And again, just socially and geographically, traditionally, most Lutheran communities existed so far away from that. And it's only been, certainly in the post-World War II era, that most people of German or Scandinavian Lutheran background have even lived anywhere in environments where there are racial issues and concerns. So again, the initial reaction to this is just strangeness, fear, stereotypes coming through media, a lot of distress, and it takes a period of time to begin to think through all that, I think.
Do you think part of it is because most of our ancestors came through a kind of a time of trial and depression and hardship, and so they reached this comfort level, and now we're just happy to sit in it?
Does that ring a bell, a note of truth somewhere? I'm afraid. That hits a little too close to home.
So now, some of our ancestors were pretty up on that. The most fluent person in teaching English as a second language to Hispanics was a Norwegian immigrant in our area.
There's one.
And she worked at that, yeah. But, you know, and she was such an example that for years that was the only thing she did was go out on the street, because she knew how she had been hurt by non-English when she came. And she did nothing but work with immigrants.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I really, you know, I can't categorize them all.
But yeah, probably within communities, you've always had those folks who say, look, you're making it, but remember. Yeah. And those are valuable people.
She dared work in an area, yeah, I will defend.
We ought to hold those names up and put them up somewhere in stone or whatever. They're very valuable people. Any final comments or thoughts? Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.